The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Women with Balls, where I, Katie Balls, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today comes from something of a political dynasty. Both her father and uncle were MPs, and the former represented the very same seat that she now currently holds. She studied PPE at Oxford before working as a researcher in Hillary Clinton's office in the early 2000s, but she eschewed a political career to work firstly as a journalist and then as a barrister. But in 2019, she became MP for Newbury, and she now works across both the Home Office and Ministry of Justice. My guest today is Laura Farris. Laura, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. We always begin by asking the same question, which is, was yours a happy childhood? I mentioned in the introduction the fact that politics runs in your family.
Yes, it was a very happy childhood. And it was a political childhood.
Were you very conscious of your father's job? And that might sound silly, but like I said, my dad would leave and disappear and come back, and I never really thought about what he did. But if your father was an MP, was kind of the parts of that something you saw quite a lot?
Well, I was his only child, and I was born when he was 48. And I don't think he thought he was going to be a dad. And my mum was married before, and so I've got half siblings. But I think by the time it got to me, you know, my mum was just like so exhausted with all the kids. I was always up with them, having dinner with them. I kind of went to bed when they went to bed almost. And so I was always sitting around the table, and my dad talked about politics all the time. I mean, it was kind of obligatory, whether he was talking about the constituency or talking about Westminster. And it definitely had quite a strong impact on me. And I definitely had a strong sense that it was his vocation, not a chore, a passion. And I think that did filter through to me. He also died when I was 14, though. So it was a kind of an interrupted childhood. And it was very different after that. Not that, you know, my mum and I are really close. It wasn't that my family life was any, you know, that there weren't very close relationships and very close to my siblings too. But it was something material shifted from that moment, of course. I mean, it defines you, something like that.
And I suppose this might sound a bit cliche, but after that moment, was it one of those things where you grow up a bit faster?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that is true of growing up, isn't it? It's not linear. There are kind of stuttering moments when you advance a lot, and that was one of them, probably my first, actually.
And what were you like at school? Because I mentioned Oxford, barrister, journalist. I know I sound arrogant because I'm going to say the high achieving and I'm a journalist. So were you very studious?
I was quite studious, and I liked English and history and politics. I did politics A-level. I liked debating and I liked all that side of things. And I remember being quite hot-headed and quite passionate about certain issues and sort of becoming more almost insubordinate as I went through my teens and challenging ideas that I'd accepted before, definitely being drawn to politics, political issues, things like that, yes.
And what kind of issues were you, I suppose, challenging? Because I wondered too, did you feel your father was a Conservative MP? Mm. Did you feel as though you were affiliated to a party when you were kind of that age? Was it more the issues that you were kind of getting your teeth into?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I remember becoming very interested in Northern Ireland, and I suppose it would have been in the years, I left school in 96, and it would have been in the years leading up to the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. And my dad was such a passionate unionist. And I remember, because I'm Catholic, actually, remember sort of the more I read around it, being like, but is there more, you know, is there more nuance in this? And feeling more, you know, that was just one example of an issue where I started trying to challenge some of the orthodoxies I'd grown up with. And through that, I think I had the characteristics of lots of young people who are interested in politics, extremely opinionated, were sure I was right, brooked no criticism of my views, a nightmare in many ways. But actually through that process, I think I did start to develop the contours of the kind of politician I was going to be, which is I started to think about things more broadly, not accept everything I'd been told, try and consider the other side of the argument. That I remember that crystallising, I think, when I was in the sixth form.
And then you choose to go and study PPE,
yeah,
which is obviously known a bit on this podcast, but also, you know, it's almost the go-to degree if you want to be a politician. So did you have that in your mind at all? And how did you find applying for Oxford?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I felt like when I left Oxford, I felt like I'd approached the whole thing wrong, because my school didn't have heavy kind of output into that university. And so I always felt like, oh, everybody's going to be so clever. And when I applied, I remember all these boys who seemed unbelievably confident and clever. And I felt very intimidated by them. And that kind of actually sense of inferiority slightly accompanied me through the whole time. And I always thought I was kind of having to mask something. And at the beginning, you have to do economics, and it was quite mathsy. In fact, I was the only person, I went to Lady Margaret Hall, I was the only person of the nine of us who hadn't done maths A level. And I remember feeling like, oh God, I don't really understand. You know, they do equations, they barely understood the equations. And there was also a section on pure logic, and that was really difficult. But actually, by the end of it, I did okay. And I remember regretting that, obsessing over whether or not I was of the right calibre, and I hadn't just accepted it more. And I also actually really regret kind of, I think, not making more of the opportunities. You know, I remember, like, the Secretary General of NATO was talking one afternoon and I instead was in the pub or something. You know, all the things that young people have, and you look back on it and think, that was such an amazing opportunity that I squandered.
Yeah, and you're watching Neighbours.
Exactly.
Did you get involved at all in terms of student politics while you were at Oxford?
I didn't get involved. It seemed, I have to say, I found it quite off-putting, actually. And I didn't draw to the kind of spectacle of 18-year-olds pretending they were prime minister, which was a little bit my impression of the union. And I'm saying this, and I actually have got really good friends who were in the union now, so I don't want to... that was just my impression.
I also stayed away from my union, so yeah.
But I just... That was sort of my impression a bit, and I didn't... I still really like politics, but I just didn't find the student cohort exactly where I wanted to be when I was 19, 20.
And I think you said in a previous interview that you perhaps in your youth were a bit more to the left than you are now. Is that fair? Was that during that period or...?
Yes, I think that is fair. But I've never been very rigid in my thinking, you know, and I don't think... It wasn't that a sort of I was... You know, there's not kind of history where I was a radical or in an alternative political party, but I was always quite open to how political ideas took root, what worked best. I didn't sort of feel very, very committed to conservatism at the age of 20. No, that would be true.
So you're finishing university, and at that point, what did you decide to do? Because I know you did an internship for Hillary Clinton during your time as a senator. You also had the interest in journalism. What came first?
I think I was a bit immature actually when I left university, and I was, to be completely honest, at the time when I was young, I had a sort of, my then boyfriend lived in New York, and so I was quite attracted by that. But she was a new senator for the state of New York, obviously had been first lady, and I got the idea of applying and trying to see if I could get something in her office, and I had to push really hard for that. But it was a really formative experience, actually, for two reasons. First of all, even though my father had been gone for about 10, not quite 10 years by then, 10 years maybe, it was a reminder, actually, of what constituency politics was like, because even though the Clintons were kind of the king and queen of the Democratic Party at that point in time, still in her office in New York was still doing the kind of grind of constituency work. And I was reminded how much I enjoyed doing that. And I was also reminded what the power of a politician's office, the difference that can make for a constituent when you intercede on their behalf. And actually, that's carried through. That's true now. And the other thing, I think, no, without this sounding hackneyed, it was clear that she was probably going to have a run at the top job, and no woman had ever done that seriously, ever. And it was really inspiring, actually, to see somebody who was quite unabashed about the fact that they were heading for the absolute top in politics. And, you know, beyond Margaret Thatcher in the United Kingdom, there just weren't very many models of that. And so it was really interesting to be a fly on the wall of the Clinton machine for a period of time.
Yeah, and as you say, I think Hillary Clinton has got a lot of flack in the past. Some Tories who've criticised her. And obviously she did not succeed in the end with her presidential run. But did you find her to be someone you admired in that way?
So, I mean, I was at the very bottom of the food chain. But she used to have sort of quarterly meetings with all her staff. And it was quite a small office. I think it was about maybe 18 people or something. And so we'd see her and we'd sort of, you might accompany her on a visit, but obviously she'd be mainly meeting whoever she was meeting on that visit and giving the speech. But about once every two or three months, she would go into this sort of big room in the basement of the building and she would take questions and it would be really informal and we'd have some tea. And I really recall how, you know, she was so intellectually capable, and it didn't matter what issue was thrown at her. She didn't need any prep on the issue. She always had, you know, like the very best politicians do, she had complete mastery of the facts of her brief and beyond. She was really, really good. I remember asking her, I think, about Northern Ireland, because it was quite soon after the conclusion of the peace process, and the Clintons, Bill Clinton, had been a big part of that. And just her knowledge of all the characters and the intricacies and how difficult it had been to kind of get that to work was just really, really impressive. She wasn't even directly involved in it.
So you finish your stint in America.
Yeah.
And then at that point, did you think about staying there longer? What made you, I think you come back and study law, or did journalism
come between? I worked in Washington as an internship again, but it was paid. So, and I was a kind of cub reporter for BBC News in Washington, and I'd be sent out. So it was the era of the Bush-Kerry presidential campaign, and I would get sent out to do, like, the cheapest story. So normally I went to states like West Virginia or somewhere where you could just go on the bus and nowhere fancy, and I'd have to find a kind of a splinter group who would be very opinionated and do, like, Vox Pops for Five Live and stuff like that. And so I came back to the UK because I was offered something at Reuters again, but on a kind of freelancey basis, but also my visa ran out, and it just seemed like the right time. I've got friends like you who are journalists, but I wasn't actually very good at it. And I had been thinking about law for some time, like the rigor and I'd been thinking about becoming a barrister because I like making arguments. And so that's what got me there. And I got a scholarship to take me through the next stage. So basically I had funding to study law. That's how it went. But I was quite an old law student. I didn't start properly until I was 28 in practice.
Now, talk us through, I mean, becoming a barrister, clearly it's seen as definitely one of the harder ways to go in terms of law routes, in terms of places, in terms of the fact you're self-employed for a lot of the time. Yeah. Also, it's making arguments. How did you find, you know, when you joined the bar, what was that experience like? And was it perhaps more male than female dominated? Or?
Well, the bar has an enduring problem. Well, when I went, I mean, I enjoyed training, I enjoyed my pupillage, I enjoyed learning the kind of mechanics of court and constructing an argument. I mean, in the interview I did for my chambers, I remember they asked me to, you know, they'd given me something to prepare in the room outside, which was an argument for one side. And then in the room they said, now we're going to give you 30 seconds and we want you to argue the opposite position. And that's absolute training for what it is, because you can find yourself on any day doing that. But I think one of the issues that has always existed at the bar, and I'm not sure that it's really gone away, is that there is a really high attrition rate. So there's a lot of women particularly who start. And then because I think partly because you're self-employed, and so if you take maternity leave, for example, it's, you know, normally your practice has taken a bit of a hit and it can be hard to rebuild. You're being sent around the country. And, you know, I can remember just feeling, you know, just that sort of peripatetic lifestyle can be harder to manage. So at the senior end, it was quite male, but at the junior end, much more mixed.
And then I suppose just before we go on to your move to politics, during your legal career, were there any particular cases you were particularly kind of like stuck with you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think actually, so there are probably two things that were quite, because I did employment law, and I did quite a lot of sex discrimination work. And that's partly because women always get instructed to do those sorts of cases. And in the early days, I was doing quite a lot of the kind of what we used to call the Sex in the City cases. And so some of the stuff that they had seen, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be the root of their complaint. Often it would be more about whether they'd been promoted or something like that. But being having to go along to strip clubs and be part, and if they didn't want to, that was sort of, you know, really degrading stuff that was normalised in the most high paid professions. And I remember finding that quite shocking and gross. And I actually think, you know, I was starting that kind of work in 2006-07. I actually think society, I often think back to those early cases and think we've moved a lot as a society. I don't think that would be normal anymore in any workplace. I think it'd be absolutely shocking and no big company would ever want their name associated with that. But normally those companies would be defending on, like, you know, so things like that, a bit of a measure of social progress and some of the stuff that people had to endure that. And I also, after I had my kids and they were tiny, moved from, I was still in a chambers, but I worked on the independent inquiry on child sexual abuse. And I applied to do that because it was kind of London based and therefore, you know, easier to manage with a young family. And that was definitely, I mean, you know, that kind of encompassed everything from the kind of grooming gangs to the Catholic Church to boarding schools. And actually, I think work like that is inherently political because you have to ask yourself how children have been so fundamentally, particularly with the come some of the cases in the north of England were so fundamentally failed by the state. And I think from doing that and thinking about law and legal principles in a different way, I do think I started to sort of feel much stronger impulse to rather than just going back to my chambers and churning through cases in the same way, to kind of accelerate into a more public forum and into politics. I can remember being on the inquiry and thinking that the next move would be to try to be in politics and public life.
And so you begin to have that feeling, and then what are the steps you start to take? And, you know, we've had some people on this podcast who say when they have turned around and told their family, oh, I want to be an MP, and they go, what? Yeah. But of course it ran in your family a bit.
Yeah, so. My mum didn't want me to do it, actually, and she was very down on it, and she found a lot of reasons why it wouldn't work. And, you know, I did the kind of normal stuff. I mean, I got myself onto the candidates list through the application. I had support from Women to Win, which is the Conservative Party's kind of organisation that, you know, just helps you with training, getting your speeches ready, getting you... I was brand new to the list and I fought a seat in East London. And it was, I fought John Cryer, the Labour MP. And I think actually he might have got his best ever result ever in the like 20 years he's had that seat when he was against me. But even so, and even though it was not a place where the Conservatives, you know, necessarily were particularly successful, I really, really enjoyed making the Conservative case. And I really enjoyed the hustings, even though I found them, I think, one of those hustings might be the most difficult advocacy experience I've ever had in my life. I still really enjoyed trying to develop the argument. And I thought to myself, and I couldn't stop thinking about that election afterwards, actually, thinking about what it was like to run in a seat and how I would have improved it. And I also thought, well, if I liked it that much in a place where they were never going to choose me, then I should probably, you know, think about trying to get somewhere where I could actually get in.
And when Newbury came up as an option, did it feel like things were clicking together, given it was, you know...
Well, it felt like an enormous challenge because I wasn't expecting it. We just moved down to the area about 6 months earlier because we'd sort of decided that we would move nearer my mum and kind of get the kids out of London, all the normal stuff where people leave cities. And the MP, Richard Bennion, I was helping out in his office, but he was not, you know, there was no sense from him that he was going to stand down. And I was sort of vaguely mulling what other places I might be able to make an argument for. And then so he sort of very, very surprisingly just, I can't remember the sequence, but Boris had intimated that an election was coming. You know, there was an impasse in Parliament and Richard announced that he was going to call it a day. And so I knew that I would at least have to have a go at that seat. And when I went for the selection, actually, my husband said that he said he was really, really worried on the way in because he was like, he knew that it would floor me if I didn't make it through. And it's hard to convey to an audience of people you don't know how much something means to you personally. And in fact, it's quite important that you don't seem emotional when you're doing it, but it can be difficult when it is an inherently emotional thing to be doing.
And you got through it?
Thank God, yes.
And then you very quickly, I suppose quicker than you perhaps expected, are suddenly an MP in Parliament.
Yeah.
And you're part of a big group too.
Yeah,
like, you know, there's
like
loads
there was
of you.
100 and it's a contested number, isn't it? I think it was 100 and something.
Yeah, the WhatsApp group said, I think it's at 109. But there's 100, now there's fewer. We can definitely say that.
There were many new MPs that year. Yeah, and actually, we were this like rabble, really, I suppose. When I think back to it, how almost naive everybody was, and there was this huge focus on the new arrivals from the Red Wall, and everybody was so sort of giddy with it all. And then less than, 3 months later, COVID began, and we were just these like really weird MPs who were always shouting into our laptops on Zoom calls with our constituents. And, you know, we were just basically these emergency MPs and we hadn't even got to know our constituents properly yet. And now that I look back on it, OK, a national crisis like that would always be difficult to deal with. But I can tell you it is totally suboptimal to be doing that when no one knows who the hell you are.
And you're now also onto your third leader, which I suppose when you'd first entered Parliament probably felt unthinkable given the size of the majority.
Yes, I'd say so, yeah.
It's almost become a bit of a cliche where it's like, you know, British politics is really turbulent, it's really volatile. But I suppose I feel like there was almost a sense in 2019 that we were heading to a calmer period because the Brexit referendum was about to be settled. Have you been taken by surprise by how much, you know, things have moved around?
I think that's absolutely right, actually. I mean, yeah. I think that the expectation was that the storm was over. I almost feel like that was the premise, actually, on which that election was kind of fought. And I think things would have settled down. And I think that I was obviously just a brand new backbencher, but looking at government now and looking at all the things that you can do in government and all the kind of manifesto pledges that you can honour, and how deeply frustrating it is to be thrown into every single element of government to be focused on managing a crisis. And do you remember in the early days, you know, it wasn't clear how many people would die, what would happen to businesses and the economy, what would happen to kids, do you remember the images on kind of hospital floors in Italy and people thinking, my God, that's going to spread all... I mean, it was just that sort of combination of fear and then just the grind of trying to kind of... help people to kind of get money out the door and learning support through the schools, all of that, it completely throws a government off course and is, I do think actually it is to the credit of Rishi that he's got things back on track within a reasonably short period of time. And I would say this, and I know nobody looks in the rearview mirror in politics, and I understand why, but when I look at my own constituency and the towns, the way that the local businesses, for example, are back on their feet, we still have record low unemployment, you know, that was almost, you know, that was profoundly at risk only 3.5 years ago or 4 years ago, and now we're through it. And that's something that is, you know... I know you don't get kind of credit for things in the past, but it is a good thing.
But you still get blamed if they don't happen, so.
Yeah, well, that's life.
I wondered how you found the parliamentary system, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think quite early on there was obviously a row about potential breach of international law under Boris Johnson. Mm. And I think you spoke on it and the need to, you know, ultimately respect the rule of law. Mm. And I think, you know, when you're a new MP, you don't quite realise sometimes if you say a certain thing before you know it, people say, oh, this person's disloyal because of X. And I wonder, did you have much of that?
Yeah, I mean, the rule of law really, really matters. And it's not just a core national value, it's a core conservative value. And if you've committed to an arrangement and then you resolve from it, I think that's a serious thing for a government to do. I wasn't comfortable with that. I made that clear.
Now, moving to your new role, you are now Parliamentary Undersecretary of State in the Home Office and the Department of Justice. Mm. It happened in the most recent reshuffle.
Yeah.
And I wanted, I mean, in terms of your brief, of course, we are a time limited on this podcast, but I thought I'd just pick up on one or two things you're focusing on. I suppose we always think about, you know, election cycles. What are the things you want to achieve between now and when election day is? One drive has been spiking. And then also, I think you've been working in terms of how we can improve prosecution and rape and so forth.
Yeah, it's not just about spiking. It's about recognising gateway offences, whether that's stalking or coercive control, or as the Angelini report kind of shone a light on, indecent exposure. Spiking is a gateway offence because it's often a gateway to more serious secondary offending. And I do think that that is an area where, both in terms of enhancing the criminal law and improving the police response, that's something that has been a real focus for me. And there's sort of more of that coming through. And I do think that actually there's been... We were one of the first countries in the world to put coercive control onto the statute book and to recognise that that underpins almost all domestic abuse. And even though putting something which actually has quite a nebulous sound, you know, very controlling person, how do you really identify that as a crime? I think even putting it onto the statute book and the way we did through the Domestic Abuse Act too has enabled policymakers, law enforcement, the courts to develop and work on their understanding. And I do think actually that we are, we shouldn't be diffident actually about the extent to which we've driven forward really significant progress in the law. And no, I won't say every element of it, you know, works perfectly all the time. But I think that we think about and we approach and we're, you know, we've been radical in areas where other countries haven't. And that's not me actually guessing. You know, I had my Swedish counterpart for a conversation. She came to the UK recently and she was talking about that coercive control. She was also talking about some of the stuff we put on the Domestic Abuse Act on sexual violence, non-fatal strangulation. She said, we have all these arguments in the Swedish parliament, but we can't agree on whether we should create crimes. But we notice you have. And it was a really satisfying email to write to her afterwards, setting out the sections of the law and how we'd done it. And equally, actually, when Alex, the Lord Chancellor, went to the United States, they were asking him questions about the law because they're thinking about doing the same stuff. And so that kind of thing, driving forward those changes and improvements is something that I've been doing since I've been in and I hope to do more of before the election. And also, actually, I'd just say on rape, when I came in, rape prosecutions were far too low. And the reason for that, I think, as is quite well known, is there had been a couple of cases which had collapsed on the eve of trial because of fundamental failures in police disclosure. And they should never have got to court. And so people nearly lost their liberty in cases that should never have reached that point. But what came afterwards was this almost crisis of confidence, I think, in the police and the CPS. And then when the government did the end-to-end rape review, you know, it's easy to sort of say, oh, well, it was just... But when you look now at how a victim experiences the system, the way that the police investigate, they've got this new model that's been rolled out just in the time I've been a minister, Operation Soteria. Some forces are now referring more than quadruple the volume of cases to the CPS, and the CPS are responding accordingly. And when I go and meet, for example, we have these people, independent sexual violence advisors, who are kind of like lay people who will just hold a victim's hand from the minute they go to the police until the end of the process. And they keep people engaged when they might be thinking, oh, I don't know about, you know, when you think about the way victims are supported and the way they, the, and actually the possibility, the real material possibility of getting justice now, I think it is night and day. And actually, I don't think there's ever been a moment in our history where there's been more of a kind of concerted focus on this crime. And this crime, I think, is the most serious crime anyone can experience that isn't, you know, that isn't murder, basically. And I suppose my job, actually, I suppose in some ways, is to reveal that work. But sometimes in Parliament, we've kind of got stuck on this sense that victims don't get justice. And I think that's changed. That's changed in a radical way in the last 5 years. And that's something that not only I'm proud of, but I'm absolutely determined to keep going with.
And one of the things Labour's pushing for at the moment, or says they would do, is almost fast-tracking of rape cases in terms of the court queue.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I think that ignores a really profound difficulty, which is that being somebody, whether you're a lawyer or a judge, who hears rape cases, that is really hard, grueling work. So we, Alex and I, recently met with the Bar Council, and we were talking to them about practitioners who practice in rape. And they were saying, you know, there's this kind of well-being element, because if you go as a lawyer and you do rape case, it really takes its toll. And that's one of the things that I do think is a practical obstacle to, I think, what Labour has suggested, specialist rape courts, because judges don't want to do every one of these cases. After you've done a rape case, you might just want to do a criminal damage case or something, or a kind of domestic burglary case, because it's much less emotionally draining. And we have to be realistic about the human element, actually, of sitting in these cases.
We mentioned the spiking.
Yeah.
I wondered how you found it when you were, you know, doing some quite progressive work on that. And then the row became about comments James Cleverly said, a joke he made, inverted commas, about, you know, spiking and his wife and, you know, part dosing. Was that tough? Was it frustrating and distraction?
James was one of the most keen and enthusiastic and committed ministers to getting this onto the statute book. And there had been, actually, there were some competing arguments about not creating new laws and about whether the laws already worked and whether we were overcomplicating it. There was quite a lot of reasons not to do it. And James is one of the strongest advocates. I know that, you know, those comments, you know, I mean, he was making a joke that his wife wasn't good enough for him, but it wasn't the right, you know, I get it. But he wasn't half-hearted. He drove it forward.
Judged by their actions.
Yeah.
There's a big debate on the ECHR at the moment. And, you know, potentially the Tory manifesto. Of course, we're not going to make you say what should be in the Tory manifesto. But I was interested in an interview where you said you had some sympathy with the views of Jonathan Sumption. He wrote a cover piece for The Spectator on leaving the ECHR. Where do you sit on this?
Well, I think that the framework of human rights laws overall is very important, and I think that it, on the whole, works very well. Where I'm interested in his views is he says, or he has written really compellingly, actually, that you could repatriate those rights. So you would have exactly the same, basically, in domestic law with some qualifications because of some of the challenges about whether or not, you know, for example, there are sort of jurisdictional exclusions and things that are much harder to participate in when you have the ECHR as a kind of international system of laws. So I'm broadly in favour, I am in favour of all the fabric of laws that contribute to the convention rights. But I think having a sensible discussion about whether or not some of the most fundamental questions of border control are allowed to operate in the way that the domestic population wishes them to, and whether the laws are working as well as possible, isn't unreasonable. And the reason it isn't unreasonable is if you take the convention and also the Refugee Convention, both of those were created in the sort of early 1950s. They were they were a direct reaction to the Second World War. They were catering for a different environment, for a different set of circumstances. Before the era of mass travel, before you could, before it was even conceivable that somebody would cross borders in the way that they do. And I think you can't, as a policymaker, I think you're remiss if you don't allow yourself to, you know, challenge your own thoughts on that and to ask yourself, are the laws for 70 years ago still the laws we want in the future? I think that's a legitimate question to ask.
And the final question on this podcast, a slightly more cheery one, not that the ECHR isn't cheery, is one we ask everyone, which is, what is the worst advice you've ever been given? Which you could have taken, you could have told them to go away.
I just think, like, generally when I was young, I was often told not to be opinionated and, you know...
Smile.
Not to be so hot, you know, not to be too opinionated. And I think, you know... probably most women in politics have got there by being quite opinionated.
Thank you, Laura, for coming on today.
Thanks.